Okay, so we can begin our exploration of this theme of our own desire, and can I say, as Buddhists, can we want anything? And of course, the short answer is yes. We'll spend the whole day sort of parsing that out. Understanding the nature of desire and the difference between say in the Buddhist tradition and in the Buddhist teachings. There's actually, since in the English language, there's kind of the word desire, it has particular connotations. But in the Buddha's teaching, he points to, say, desire as the cause of suffering. Which you think in the Four Noble Truths, desire is the cause of suffering, so therefore desire must be bad. But that has that's a particular word in the scriptural language, tanha, and tanha is a kind of desire that has it's associated with greed, hatred, and delusion. It always ends in suffering. It has a pretty fixed course, but there's also other words for desire, and say one of the words is chanda that the Buddha uses, and it's translated in the translations. It's always translated as desire, it has a different. A very different connotation, because it's the kind of desire that is, it's actually part of the a set of teachings that the Buddha gave that is a part of the wings to awakening. There's a particular set of teachings that the Buddha gave that are considered essential to the path to liberation and awakening, and one of them is the it's called the four bases of spiritual success, and then the first factor of that is chanda, is desire. Of course, it's a wholesome desire. It's an aspiration, or it's a motivation, or it's interest. And you see that if we're going to have any kind of successful spiritual path, then we have to have some kind of a motivation. We have to take an interest. We have to formulate a desire, and the within that teaching, the next say quality, the next factor is effort, energy. So that there's a and again for spiritual success. We have to put forth some kind of effort. It's not that just by having a nice idea, being a nice Buddhist, that it's going to do the trick. You actually have to put some effort into it. Very much a part of the Buddha's path as well, in the sense of effort. There's a couple ways that the Buddha characterized his teaching or his dispensation. One is it's a path of wisdom, that's just relying on wisdom. He also characterized it as a kiriyavada, which just means a teaching based on action, effort. One has to engage, one has to put forth effort, there has to be some action involved in it. It's not a path of, say, passivity or a path of non-action or fatalistic, in that whatever you do, you just have to wait long enough or be around long enough, and somehow it's all going to result in some kind of spiritual awakening. It doesn't quite work like that. I remember a long time ago, I think I had just become a monk, I was just living in a monastery, and a New Yorker magazine showed up at the monastery, and it's New Yorker. They've got the best cartoons. And I remember, just reading it and liking it and actually writing it down. But it was a sort of a picture of a kind of a park and a couple guys on a park bench, looking kind of disheveled and not very clean, and with a couple bottles between them, and so they're. And they're talking with each other, and one of them says, "Let's face it, Sid. Not having been born great, nor having achieved greatness, one can only assume we'll have it thrust upon us." and it's sort of the same thing of, not having been born enlightened, or not having achieved it, maybe it'll just be thrust upon us somehow. No, it doesn't work like that. You actually have to conceive of a desire, an aspiration, and you have to work towards that. You have to put forth some effort. It's a necessity. But then, of course, the formulating of, say, of a desire, of an aspiration, and acting upon it, then has to be tempered by wisdom and discernment. That has to have, there has to be an appropriate application. Because it's in that appropriate application that we learn, and that we actually, say, move forward on the path and reap the fruits of it. So that our practice relies on that seed of motivation, of desire. So to be able to pay attention, well, what is actually a wise desire? The nature of desire, or the nature of most of our desires, is focused around how do I be happy? How do we experience happiness? And how do I, say, avoid suffering? So we have to learn about desire. And the problem, it's not that we, that it, say that it's a problem to want to be happy, and want to be free from difficulty. But we have to pay attention to what's an actual fruitful way to apply that, or to direct that. It was like yesterday at the monastery. We had a family was there. They spent a couple of nights, and they've been coming since. Since before they were married, the couple. And then they were bringing the kids every year, once or twice a year. And I think the boy's about 12, the girl's about 10. And and I was actually talking to them about sort of like this. And because I remember visiting their house, and spent a night there, and then in the morning had breakfast. And the little boy's kind of aspiration for fulfillment of desire that would bring happiness was because it was a special breakfast, get pancakes. And of course, that was the epitome of happiness for for this little boy. And not just pancakes that were soaked in syrup. and it was really great, because it was really good, because the mom sort of said, gave him the kind of you can do it the way you like it. And of course, that syrup bottle got turned up, but it was a while before it got turned back down again. But then she checked in, how's that tasting? How's it doing? Oh, he was so excited. And then, it goes on. I said, how are you feeling? He said, oh, I feel sick. And I thought that was really good, a very skillful on the mother's part to give him the direct experience of yes, sometimes you can get what you want, but sometimes it doesn't actually satisfy, or it does for a while, and then it can't fulfill, or it's because even achieving some great success in the world can be, it isn't just on a real sensual gratification just in the moment, but something like a real success in the world, some achievement or something one's always wanted to do, but then when it's done, how does it feel? Because then it's over, and you've achieved it. But then, what have you done? How have you achieved it? Because that resonates with that. That stays with us. So that how we've achieved our happiness, and what it's done. So there's all these nuances to that pursuit of happiness, that desire for happiness, that needs to be. We need to be attentive to, and this is where, say, the Buddha is not saying you can't be happy, but what he's saying is, pay attention to the, say, one, of course, the desire, but then also the object and how it's done, because in reality, of course, that was the motivation for the Buddha's quest for enlightenment. He wanted to be happy. He wanted to decrease his sense of frustration and difficulty that he experienced. So that's not a strange desire. But what is actually, say, strange or different or special is the Buddha actually maintained that desire and didn't cut corners and didn't settle for second best, I think all of us can recognize that, you know, so often we cut corners and we say, oh geez, this is, you know, we're desiring something, but then, you know, it gets a bit too onerous or a bit too difficult, and it's a bit too much, so we'll settle for something else. But the Buddha is saying, no, if you want happiness, this is really the way to do it, and this is possible in the human condition, so that one, because sometimes we think of that, you know, that when we reflect on desire, in a sense, I've got to give up my desires, and then that feels uncomfortable, or I've got to restrain them and curb them, which just feels uncomfortable. But it's more like, which we do, but it's in the pursuit of a desire for something more satisfying. It's like the ability of the mind to actually be happy and content within itself. It's not impossible in the human condition, and in fact, it's not even that difficult. It's just that we're habituated to other things. We're habituated to, inappropriate desire systems, and we're habituated to. Taking shortcuts that end up being they have their own suffering involved in them. So as we reflect on this nature of desire, how do we educate ourselves, educate our desires to be supportive of our well-being? And that's where the sense of chanda is really important. You really have to be able to formulate a desire. And this is where that teaching that I talked about of the four bases of success is, chanda is the first one, so desire, in a wholesome way, motivation, interest, effort, is the second one, effort, energy, application of energy. Third quality is the quality of what's called citta, intent, or application of the mind on what it's doing. And the fourth quality, in the scriptural language, vimamsa, which is investigation, contemplation. But what it has a particular connotation of reviewing, reflecting and reviewing. So that we monks, so we go back and reflect on it, review it. Okay, what worked? What didn't work? What was helpful? What wasn't helpful? What was the result of this? And if that process is working, then what it should do is sort of loop back and be a source of chanda. it should be a process that kind of feeds itself, and then it refines our focus and supports our motivation and desire. Really, the desires become more appropriate and for our goal. So to be able to pick up on that theme of how to apply that wanting mind to wanting something that is really fruitful, that's useful, that's beneficial, that really supports us. And that's there's a really lovely sutta in the Middle Ink Discourses where the disciple of the Buddha is asked a question by a lay person, and saying that there are many teachers or religious seekers who say that whether one formulates a desire for awakening or doesn't formulate a desire for awakening. Of course, this is a teaching in India, and whether one neither formulates and doesn't formulate, or both formulates, and those who've read the suttas know the comprehensive nature of the logic in the Buddha's time. But that sense, whatever one does, there's no fruit to it, really. One isn't going to experience awakening and liberation. And the layperson asks the disciple of the Buddha, is this, what would the Buddha's response to this be? And he sort of said, well, I'm not 100% sure, but I think he would say something to the effect that it would be more important that in terms of the appropriate or inappropriate way of he said if one follows a holy life inappropriately, so even having made a wish for results or not having made a wish for result, it's the more important thing is the way that one lives, one follows the path of practice, and if it's following it inappropriately, or then it's not going to bear fruit. But whether one, say, if one formulated a desire, if one or one didn't, but one was following a holy life, a way of practice, a way of training, appropriately, that aligned itself with Dhamma, and, whether you've conceived of a wish or not, one will reap the fruits of that. It's more around the action. It's more around the... And that that sense of that following a path of practice is, and this is when he went back to the Buddha, and the monk went back to the Buddha, asked the Buddha, saying that, have I spoken what is true? And the Buddha sort of saying, well, in answering the way that you're speaking in line with what I've said. You're not misrepresenting me with what is unfactual, and you're answering in line with the Dhamma, so that no one who's thinking is in line with the Dhamma will have grounds for criticizing you. But then he goes on to say, because of any religious seeker, that's endowed with, say, wrong view, wrong resolve, wrong speech, Eightfold Path. Yeah, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration. Even if they've made a wish, it's incapable of obtaining results. But of course, the opposite is true. It's around that path of practice, and then the Buddha gives some similes in the sense, if there were somebody who wanted some cooking oil, and somebody who's in need of cooking oil, looking for cooking oil, wandering in search of cooking oil, and you pile up a pile of gravel in a tub and press it, sprinkle water on it from time to time, press it, pound it, you wouldn't get cooking oil from that. And why is that? Why is it incapable? Because it's an inappropriate way of obtaining results. And similarly, he said, similarly, a person looking for milk, in need of milk, wandering in search of milk, and they would, and so he'd find a newly calved cow, but then he'd go and pull on the horns. So, and that would be incapable of obtaining results from that. Or somebody in need of butter, but taking water, sprinkling water on it, twirling the churning stick, and you wouldn't get butter from that. Or somebody in wanting fire. So this is 2,500 years ago, before matches, before Bic lighters. And that you have a fire stick, but then you rub it on a wet, sappy piece of wood, and you just wouldn't get fire from that. So that it's the inappropriate way to obtain results, and that of course the opposite is true, whereby one recognizes that. It is that application of the Eightfold Path, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This path of virtue, integrity, path of mindfulness and clarity, a path of wisdom and discernment. Is what brings about the results, because, and he says, and why is that? Because it's an appropriate way of attaining results, and sort of that simple logic. And in the same way, wanting oil, some cooking oil, wandering in search of cooking oil, the pile sesame seeds in a tub, press them, sprinkle water, press them, filter them, and you're going to get some oil from that. It just is because it's an appropriate way to obtain results. Same with the person seeking milk, going to a newly calved cow, but then going and pulling the udders, and that's then you'd get milk, and butter, taking curds, and spinning that with your churning stick, you're going to get butter from that, and same with fire, you take a fire stick and you've got a dry stick to rub it on, so that friction, that sapless piece of wood, you'd get fire coming from that. So it's because these are appropriate ways of receiving the results. So that sense of You know, desire is part of it, but it's also the desire has to pay attention to what's the methodology, what's the way to make this work, and as one pays attention to that, then cultivates that path, the results come. You know, in the same way as if you sit around and think about, I'm hungry, what do I do? It's lunchtime. you start thinking about it, or even looking at the food and sort of. But you don't actually eat it. It doesn't actually satiate the hunger. It doesn't fulfill the hunger. The hunger doesn't go away until one's actually eaten it. And even if one is eating it, there's no point in sort of thinking too much about it. Sort of, how do I? Because we're so used to it, that you don't sort of doubt, when am I going to be full? When will I ever be full? But it's, you just know that, oh yeah, if I do this, then I'm going to be, my hunger will go away, I'll be satiated, I'll be full. Yeah. So in the same way with our, this path of practice, a different time scale maybe. But the reality is the same in that it's this application, this living of the path of practice that produces the results. We do it, we keep doing it, and we do it wisely. I mean, this is another aspect. The appropriateness of it. It's appropriate. It's kind of, and that's why why the Buddha emphasizes the aspect of there is a wrong path of practice and there is a right path of practice. There's a path of practice that doesn't bring the results and the fruits of peace and clarity and awakening. Those are that's like an inappropriate method. Whereas the path that will result in that experience of well-being, of happiness, of clarity, of peace, awakening, that's an appropriate path. It's kind of in the English language. It's a bit difficult because the kind of right and wrong has is kind of emotionally loaded terminology that is a bit it's a bit heavy sometimes. Actually, no, you've got it wrong. It's a wrong path. And you should feel bad about that. but the word that the Buddha uses for samma, in the Pali language, samma ditti, samma sankappa, there's this right view, right resolve, right speech. That word. It's an old term in the Indian language from the area that the Buddha lived, which was it was used in musical theory, so that it was in the sense of if something is right, it meaning like it's right in terms of right in tune, or just right. So that it's like when you've got people singing together in harmony, or in our case, chanting, and you've got people who are harmonizing, chanting together, it feels right. But you can really feel it when it's not. It's like sometimes you've got, sometimes at the monastery, you'll have, people who are enthusiastic and have very strong voices, but they're out of tune. It's a real killer combination. It's really, you could just feel the energy sort of sucking out of the room. But it's something we can learn. I mean, out there, because we've had people at the monastery who've come and lived and stayed and ordained even, and when they first start chanting, it's painful, but it's something you can learn, I can remember for myself growing up, my mother belonged to a couple different choral groups and was in the church choir growing up there's music on the radio and I would sort of sing along or sing. And I can remember my mother, this painful expression. You're not listening. It's so much of actually, say, like singing and harmonizing is listening. And so that in same with, in the path of practice, this sense of right is not sort of intellectually and rationally right, but it's listening, tuning in. How does it work together? How does it harmonize? How does it, fit in with its one with each other? And how does it fit with the aspiration? So that's the nature of desire, is learning how to harmonize those, how to listen, so that we can allow that path to bear fruit, to bring results to us. Okay, I think I've talked long enough. we're going to be here for the whole day, we've had the opportunity to sit meditation. We've had the opportunity to listen to some reflections around this theme. And one of the things we could do now is take the opportunity to do some walking meditation. And particularly in the Thai forest tradition, walking meditation plays a big role in our meditation practice. So that just we're here at Spirit Rock. There's lots of flat areas around here. There's nice shaded areas. Temperature's cool today. So just encourage people to go out and find a quiet place. Walking meditation is taking the posture of walking as your a basis for establishing awareness, so that you can shift your focus of attention and mindfulness to the sensation of touch, so that with the soles of the feet touching the ground and paying attention to that lifting of the foot, moving it, setting it down, lifting it up, moving, setting down. Take depends how much you can scatter out, and but take a flat spot about say 15 paces, 20 paces, and just it's just walking back and forth. The opportunity with walking meditation is that there's, just the physical movement helps to ground oneself in the experience of the physical body. There's a continuity of mindfulness there that we can build easily by each time we get to the end, say if we've designated a path, each time you get to the end of that, stop, turn around, and just stop and recollect, am I present? Am I here? Because it's easy to get into a nice rhythm of walking back and forth, and 10 minutes, 15 minutes later, I say, what the hell? Oh, spirit rock, right. Here I am. But each time it gets to the end of the path, just to stop, reestablish, or recollect, okay, I'm present, I'm here. Okay, so we can go off for a walk meditation, ring the bell about maybe about 10 to, everybody can come back about 10 to 11, about half an hour.